Back to Migali for a minute. Did you ever fly up in that area near the Yalu?
Yes, sir. Every day we flew. That's where we went. And we were there to challenge the MiG-15s to come up and challenge any Russian-made bombers that wanted to go south, and they didn't want to go. They tried it a couple of times and were destroyed by the F-86s. But most of the combat occurred in Migali, just south of the Yalu River. And some, I might add, occurred north of the river.
General MacArthur is quoted as saying that he wanted to go across the river into China. Did you ever fly over the river and make it into China?
Next question, please. Of course I did. Yes. And it was a gamble to fly there, because a number of our guys got shot down north of the river and ended up in a Chinese prison camp, which was no... but yes, there was some combat north of the river. Most of it was in Migali.
So following, Randy, following the MiG-15 came your 17, right?
Correct.
What were the differences? Tell us that tale.
Well, yeah, the 17, and I'll tell you that and then tell you a little bit about the one we've got here, because it's unique in its own right. But the 17 was really a follow-up to the 15, much like a Super Hornet today is a follow-up to the Legacy Hornet. The regular 17, they tried to fix some of the high-speed defects in the 15. The MiG-17 would marginally go supersonic at the right altitude, right temperature, and so forth. It introduced the Soviet Union's first afterburner to a jet fighter. The wing was redesigned and went from a 42-degree sweep to about a 48 from the wing root to the center point where the drop tanks are hung. And then it's about a 45-degree sweep from there to the wing tip. It also has two different airfoils. It has an airfoil on the inner wing and a more cambered airfoil on the outer wing. And the design criteria from the Kremlin was they wanted an aircraft that would outturn any other fighter then in the sky. And as we found over Vietnam, it outturned anything we had. In fact, it outturned anything as a production aircraft until the F-16 first flew. So in a turning fight, it was a deadly aircraft. We learned to fight it above 23,000 feet in Vietnam and keep it into more of a vertical fight, which is more our fight with the F-4. This particular 17 that's beside us is one of only it's the only one of its type flying in the world. It was a add-on or a modified 17 in that when it was designed from the cockpit forward, it's 21 inches longer and has a radar. This was the Soviet Union's very first all-weather radar intercepting fighter. It was built in 1960 and spent most of its days. It was withdrawn from service fairly early because the MiG-21s all had radar, but it was designed like the 15 to be an air superiority fighter from the Soviet standpoint.
How did you get into flying all these Russian airplanes? How'd that come about?
Poor judgment. I use that line a lot. Guys with me, I think I'm probably tired of hearing it, but I started out flying air shows at the World War II stuff, A-26 and T-6 and various other World War II aircraft, and grew up around in Texas, outside of Breckenridge, Texas, which is one of the biggest warbird restoration facilities in the country. They did most of the restoration on all the Corsairs that came from the Honduras and El Salvador that were used in the TV show Black Sheep Squadron back in the late 70s and so forth. So as a kid, I was climbing all over a Mustang project or a Spitfire project or something, you know. So since I was a kid, just eat up with it, you know. So I got a gig some years ago flying a T-33. And so that was the first jet ever flew, first drop of kerosene ever burned was in a T-33, and was introduced to a program that had some MiGs in it, and that was kind of my introduction to the MiG aircraft. And the 15, flown just briefly, and it's a nice flying airplane, I suppose, but the 17 is a beautifully flying airplane. It is just so balanced. You can just fly it with two fingers. It's just a great airplane.
Have you established relationships with Russian pilots over these many years?
A few, plus Polish. And I tell you a little story. Years ago, I was at an Air Force base. I just learned to fly the 17. And there were several former Eastern Bloc, East German pilots that had flown the 17 in active duty. And so I'd read the book a million times. And And the book said that at a certain altitude and a certain speed, you know, the aircraft would go 1.04 Mach. So I was asking these guys, you know, because I didn't want to kill myself in the airplane, so I kept asking them questions about what about this, what about that, and I finally got around to the question about will it go supersonic. And one of the Germans about 3-4 bar stools down from me, he leaned back and goes, yes, it will go that fast, but it does not like it. So I never have tried to go supersonic with the aircraft. At an air show, if it's air smooth, I'll a lot of times hit 0.91, 92 at 10 or 15 feet off the deck on a straight pass. But it's not, I don't ever fly the aircraft supersonic. It's got a great rate of climb. And on a cool day, you can get to 30,000 feet in about 4 minutes with AB. So, you know, for its day, that was quite the hot rod. Right.
Doug, when did you get this thing about F-86s, and to what extent have you branched out of the Sabre jet territory?
Well, like most of these guys, I started as a kid building model airplanes and flying model airplanes, and then studied them and collected photographs. I think I had maybe the largest jet fighter collection of photographs in the world. I had like 2,000 by the time I went off to the academy. Been hooked on warbirds all my life. Started flying T-6s and then got into P-51s and SBD, P-40, Corsair, and then branched into the warbird jets. And, I had set a goal a long time ago to fly every World War II fighter. I haven't flown the P-38 or the P-47, but I've flown pretty much all the rest of them, including the Zero and the Spitfire. So,
I asked Chick about his West Point experience. Your Air Force Academy?
No, I got an appointment to the Naval Academy.
Naval Academy.
Yeah. I was going to go to the Air Force Academy, but
Your parents were married,
and yeah, and they were actually a man and woman at that time. I went to Naval Academy, and of course, if you're going to fly airplanes, Air Force is probably the place to go, but I went to the Navy.
You flew Navy or you flew Air Force?
No, I went in the Navy. And,
you did?
Navy,
yes.
Actually has an Air Force. A lot of people don't know that, but it's...
Well, my son's a Hornet pilot, so I'm up on naval aviation, yeah. But now, so you're flying all the time now? You're flying shows?
I do stay busy, yeah, we do. I brought 4 airplanes here, and I might do 10, 12 shows a year. You know, it's very time-consuming by the time, as Randy knows, by the time you get your airplanes there and back, I've got other pilots to help me. I try to fly, in order to stay current, I've got 9 airplanes. I try to fly at least one a week for at least 30 minutes, and even then, I'm not so sure I should stay current in that many airplanes.
Chick, you were quoted as saying that you spent a year as executive assistant to General Westmoreland, and you're quoted anyway as saying that it was the toughest year of your entire nearly 40 years of active duty. Why? Why was it so tough?
Yeah, I was General Westmoreland's exec in 1966 and 67 in Vietnam. I was, quote, the office help for the most part. The reason I call it the toughest year of my career, and it was, for me personally anyway, because he was such a great man and a demanding boss. And there seemed to be damn little I could do to please him for the first 6 months. He called me Colonel Cleveland. I was LC at the time. And one morning, I think I'd done something right. He kind of ground his teeth and said, "Good morning, chick." Got lucky. He'd never said that word before. And he almost never said it again. He was tough to work for, but I considered Westmoreland a great man. And if anybody has anything to say bad about him, don't say it while I'm around, please.
So, I just mentioned Navy and naval aviation versus Air Force aviation. How fulfilling, Chick, has your career been, active duty, and what's been most fulfilling about it?
Well, I spent 35 years in the Air Force and loved virtually every minute of it. I didn't enjoy getting shot at. I was never hit, by the way. Like I said, I didn't always enjoy my time with General Westmoreland, but it was a great career experience for me. But I love the idea of being able to fly airplanes, which I'd wanted to do since I was a knee-high to a grasshopper, and do it in the service of my country. Very fulfilling. I'm a mission-oriented kind of guy and always was. And the Air Force gave me a great opportunity to fulfill that longing.
Doug, how fulfilling was your military career, and what was fulfilling about it?
You know, I stayed, did the 4 years at Annapolis and then 5 years active duty and then another five in the reserves. I wanted to go to Vietnam. I knew, like Korea, it would be talked about forever. I went and I did two tours, one in the air, one in gunboats in the Delta. That was an interesting experience to be in the heat of battle for two tours. Something you put behind you, and I know why guys don't talk about it. It's just not worth, you know, it's not something you sit around and talk about a lot unless you were with the other guy that was with you. But it was just great to serve in the Navy, and it was an honor.
Same question, Randy.
Well, I didn't serve either branch, and my parents were married to each other. It's just, I guess, say first thing, it's a great honor to be sitting between these two guys. I'm just a guy that got lucky to get to fly lots of really neat aircraft and hopefully entertain a lot of people at air shows.